Hey, everybody. Good evening, everybody. My name's Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, obviously. And thanks for everybody watching online. It is a real treat to have my two good friends, Baron Bircher and Jim Thane, here tonight. They're going to be talking about their new books and all kinds of things. So please help me give them a nice, warm welcome. October welcome. Yeah. I figured we'd just have a conversation, you know, just kind of, yeah.
Yes.
I thought, you know, maybe before we get into the books themselves, I'd like to maybe have you guys talk a little bit about your lives before you became writers, because you both have very interesting backstories, starting with Mr. Bircher.
Okay, very good. My name is Baron Bircher, and in my pre-writing life, I spent a lot of years in the music business. I was a musician for a while, singer, songwriter kind of guy, and soon discovered that I was better suited for being on the other side of the studio glass, and I became an artist manager and started a small record label and was in the business portion of the music business and enjoyed it. I enjoyed both sides of it very, very much. But and it still resonates, and I think that it kind of has followed me into the writing as well, because the music tends to sneak in sometimes when I least expect it, actually, when I'm writing these things. But I always have, well, I'll talk about this later, but I always have kind of a soundtrack in mind when I'm writing a given book. And it's just a soundtrack that kind of creates its own self for me. And I've learned to use it as kind of guardrails for any given story. And it kind of keeps me on the beam, so to speak, when I'm writing a certain book with a certain storyline. And that certain music that is floating around in my head always keeps the tone and the content in sync. I know you know that feeling, but I think that's kind of how my former life and my present life as a writer really coexist and kind of feed one another, actually.
In a sense, I'm not sure I ever had a life before I decided to become a writer, because I decided I wanted to be a writer when I was a very young child, you know, reading books. And I started to read at a very early age. And I think I was about the fourth or fifth grade when it one day occurred to me that, boy, I'd really like to be the guy who writes the book rather than reads the book. So I always had a desire to write. And when I finally managed to graduate high school and go to college, I went to college as a pre-law major, and pretty early on decided that the life of a college professor looked like a pretty good deal, because you could teach, you could do research, and you could write. And so I thought, okay, you can write, somebody pays you to do it, you don't have to starve. So I ultimately did become a history professor and worked in that area for a number of years. I wrote a number of journal articles and that sort of thing, and one nonfiction book. And then when I finally decided to give that up, I intended to write nonfiction. I was working on a nonfiction book when the idea for a novel fell into my lap one day, and I couldn't get rid of it. So I decided to start playing around with it, and after a while, I had the germinations of a book. So I gave up my nonfiction project. I've never gotten back to it, and started to write novels.
What was the nonfiction project?
I had done a nonfiction book while I was still teaching, about a woman who was the wife of the first territorial governor of Montana. This is a middle-class Ohio housewife in 1863 who gets dragged out of her comfortable existence in Ohio, where she's got a nice house, she's got domestic help, dragged across the frontier to what is now southwestern Montana to this very rude mining camp filled with, well, you saw deadwood. At any rate, so she lived there for 2 years while her husband was first the territorial, the Chief Justice of Idaho. Then Montana was split off from Idaho. He becomes the territorial governor. And so she becomes Montana's first lady. So I did that book and later on decided that I wanted to broaden that out to a book about the life of women generally on the Rocky Mountain mining frontier. So that was the nonfiction book that I was working on when I set it aside to write my first novel.
Did it ever get published?
I never finished it. I was still doing research.
You know, it seems like that would make a fun historical novel, you know?
Yeah, it probably would. It's...
Yeah. You know, you read those accounts, you know, these territorial, I think of, was it Mary Summer Hayes who wrote Vanished Arizona? But God, we're so soft. You know, you read those, you read those accounts,
exactly
what they went through, and it's like, my God, amazing.
Yeah, well, just the, imagine just the emotional stuff that she had to go through.
Absolutely. I mean, in Ohio, she's very close to her mother, her sister. She's got a big circle of friends, her church. And, I mean, she's just literally torn away from all of that and sent out to this godforsaken frontier. And her husband, once he gets there, promptly leaves her and goes back to Washington, D.C., leaving her pregnant, alone, no doctor except for some old guy, and her 13-year-old niece to take care of her through this pregnancy. I mean, I can't imagine an ordeal.
And like, 8 months of snow.
I mean, she just sucks it up, and, you know, that's the way life is. And
now, I think when I first met you, Jim, you were going back and forth between Illinois and Scottsdale, right?
Yes,
and that's
right.
Were you still working at that time? Or?
No. Oh, wait a minute. I take that back. Yeah, when we started coming to Scottsdale on vacation, and it was just immediately after I left teaching that we bought a condo here and started splitting time before we moved here full time.
Right, and I was telling some of the folks here tonight that, you know, Jim's been, we're both part of a discussion group here at the store, and so is Pam and Jim, and that's been meeting here for how long, Jim? 23 years now, something like that? It's all devoted to hard-boiled and noir fiction, and so we have a great time with
that. Yeah, we do.
Yeah. Well, I want to kind of go back and forth with you guys because your books are so rooted in place. And when I first met you, Baron, I think you were living in Hawaii at the time.
Yeah, the first series that features Mike Travis, who is a retired cop, PI, was an L.A. cop. And based on a very good friend of mine that I kind of borrowed pieces of his life and borrowed pieces of his stories. And
music very much a part of those books.
Music very much a part of the, especially the first couple of those, Roadhouse Blues being the first. But anyway, I was living in Hawaii at the time, and I set the books in Hawaii where, you know, I could keep my character close and give me a really good excuse to go do stuff that I wouldn't ordinarily do and call it research. And it was great fun. That turned out to be one of the better experiences. Well, as we find out when you do that kind of thing, research is a blast. Sometimes it's hard to give up doing the research to do the writing.
So then with the Ty Dawson books, of which this is number
This is number three.
South California Purples was the first one.
First one, yeah.
And then Fistful of Rain, and then the new one, Reckoning. And these are set in very specific place and time, 1970s Southern Oregon, rural.
Yes.
A change is coming. That's the theme.
Books. And there's a reason for that. We could come back to it if you'd like to mix this up a little bit more.
Sure.
But there is a reason that is the tone and tenor in place.
Right.
Yeah, but I was going to ask that question myself. I really like the fact that you set these books in the 1970s, and Ty Dawson can go out and investigate cases the old-fashioned way, using his wits, using his shoe leather, using his ability to judge people, using his ability to interview people successfully. He's not just sitting in front of a damn computer, you know, analyzing DNA evidence or looking for video surveillance stuff. But I wondered, is that the reason why you decided to set these books in the 70s, or is there another reason?
No, that is one of the, that's part of the happy fallout, is that there's no internet and there's no cell phones and there's none of that gobbledygook that to me has become so incredibly distracting.
Yeah. You can't get away with anything these days. As if on cue.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
No, but every...
I mean as a tool in a book.
Every street corner now is under cameras, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, what's a thief supposed to do?
Well, yeah, exactly. How are you supposed to be clever?
Yeah.
But the 70s thing, I'll give... The short version of it is this. I found out that my dad was terminally ill. And we were, my family, fortunately, was close, and we didn't have a bunch of gobbledygook to have to sort through, which was a real great thing. So with the time that we had, it really started to dawn on me that in the 1970s, when he and my mom were raising three kids, I'm the youngest of three, my oldest brother was getting ready to graduate high school and become eligible for the draft for Vietnam. My sister was a very attractive cheerleader in high school, which had problems, I'm sure, all kinds of other problems. And I was in junior high school. And I kind of didn't really understand any of it other than taking notes on what not to do so I wouldn't get in trouble the way that they were getting in trouble. And that's what my dad and I talked about, was what was it like to raise kids in the 70s? Because I was looking through the eyes of a pre-teenager. And the more he talked, the more I thought, good Lord. You know, I have recollections about what it was like in the early 70s that are, you know, very close to home, as all of our recollections are. So they're easy to write about in that sense. But the challenges of what was going on culturally was a whole other matter that I don't think anybody was prepared for. You know, they were raised in the Eisenhower era, and all of this other stuff, who saw that coming? And what do you do about it? So that was it's been a fun thing to arm wrestle with, and it's a fun way for me to continue to spend time with my dad.
Nice. Well, you know, Jim, you've done four books set here in Phoenix, really terrific police procedurals, the latest of which is called South of the Deuce, and it's probably good to have you explain the story of how you came with that title.
Okay. South of the Deuce. So years ago, some of you may remember, I know Patrick does, the Poison Pen opened a second store, which was down just south of Chase Field. And there was a grand opening party, and there were a whole bunch of people there. And Barbara Peters, who owned the store, was introducing people in the audience. And one of the people she introduced was John Talton. John is a Phoenix native. He used to be a columnist for the Arizona Republic. Now he's in Seattle. And Barbara mentioned that John was an authority on Phoenix neighborhoods. And she said, "As I think that the area we're in now used to be known as the Deuce." And from the audience, John said, "No, the Deuce was north of here." Two thoughts immediately came to mind. This, you know how this works. I thought, okay, so first of all, we're south of the Deuce. And secondly, I thought, wow, that would be a really good title for a crime novel. So I had a project I was working on, and it just wasn't really going anywhere. So I set that aside and spent some time researching the history of the Deuce and getting to know that area a bit, and wrote a book that I thought would fit the title. So my agent sold the book, and the very first thing the editor said to me was, we love this book, but we're really not knocked out about the title at all. Do you have any other bright ideas? For those of you who don't know, the publisher always has the final say, both on the cover art and on the title. Now, if you're Stephen King or somebody like that, right, you can say, the hell with you. That's my title, and that's the title that's going on the book. But when you're a debut writer, you have absolutely no leverage at all, and all you can do is say, sure, fine, I'll take care of that. So I came up with another title, which was No Place to Die, which the publisher liked a lot better. And in the editing process, I then went through and scrubbed out all the references to the Deuce, because I still loved that title, and I thought someday I'm going to be able to use that. So that book was published as No Place to Die, and then that was the first of the books in my Sean Richardson series. And the fourth book later, I came up with another idea that I thought would perfectly fit the title South of the Deuce. And this time, I had a different publisher who loved the title. And so that's the sordid history of how that title came about.
May I ask a question? Do you find that when you have a title in your head before you start your project, that somehow it feels different as you're writing it?
So I'm not sure, because that's the only time it's ever happened to me. That's the only time I've ever written a book having the title in mind first. Normally, well, this one came close for reasons I could explain later, but normally I've always kind of wrestled with titles and then said to the publisher, do you have any bright ideas? South of the Deuce was the only one I really fell in love with.
I love that title.
Ever got anywhere.
That was awesome.
Well, and the first thing Barbara said to me when I told her the story, she said, well, that's terrible. I liked South of the Deuce a lot better.
Well, see, the title itself is mysterious, and that's what's so much fun about book titles, you know?
Yes.
I love the title South California Purples.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Which is a song title, of course. It is. It's a title. In fact, almost all of my book titles, I think, with one exception, are drawn from the musical world. But South California Purples is a song by Chicago on their very first album, Chicago
Really?
Transit Authority. And I'm going to name drop now because it's just so much fun. I was talking with Chicago's producer, James William Guercio, who built Caribou Ranch and all of that stuff. And we were chatting, and I said, you know, someday I'm going to write a book called South California Purples. And he goes, oh, God, yeah, you have to do that. So do you have any idea what it means? He goes, no.
But that's good, because then you can make it mean anything you want.
Exactly. So, and I did. But it was great. I've just always been so enamored with just how, what the hell that whole title was. And it still is. I still kind of look at it and think. And I have people benching that to this day. What's the title mean? We're not telling.
Yeah, I'm sure people assume one thing, you know, but it makes you want to find out. And some titles are like, eh, what does that mean? I don't care, you know. But anyway.
Well, it beats, you know, the dead guy.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Well, Jim, and you, so Arizona and then Montana.
Right.
And then in Tyndall, is it Tyndall?
Tyndall. Yes.
That, I mean, let's just kind of go all over the place, if you don't mind.
Okay.
The story behind Tyndall is so interesting. I remember you were talking about it when you were writing it.
Right.
We will get to the new book, don't worry, but let's go down memory lane a little bit.
Tyndall is a little town in South Dakota, tucked way down in the corner near both Iowa and Nebraska. And my grandmother was born there. My mother was born there. And my grandfather died there in 1925 when my mother was only 5 years old. And as a little boy, I can't remember how old I must have been, 7 or 8, I asked my mother, so what happened to Granddad? How did he die? And my mother said, well, he was killed in a bank robbery. And then she quickly changed the subject, never mentioned his name again. And I, even at that age, I could tell the subject is totally off limits. But it was very strange. There were no pictures of the guy any place in the house. My grandmother, my mother never mentioned him. There was never any mention of his birthday, never any mention of their anniversary, nothing. And so just after my mother died, Patrick mentioned that I, at the time, was driving back and forth between Montana and Illinois. And so one summer, driving out from Illinois to Montana, I reserved a couple of days. I had checked and discovered that the little Carnegie Library in Tyndall had all the newspapers back from the 1920s. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to detour off the highway here, and I will spend an afternoon in the library looking at the newspapers because I want to know about this bank robbery. So I knew that my grandfather had died on May 20th, 1925. So I'm got the microfilm jacked up there in the library. I'm rolling through it, and I come to the issue of the paper for May 21st, 1925, and it's the headline is, "Local Banker Shoots Himself in the Vault." My grandfather had committed suicide in the bank's vault. That's what I thought.
That's a statement.
So I basically had no time to do anything with this other than just read a few quick newspaper articles. But it's a long, involved story involving corruption in the bank. But my grandfather was the assistant cashier. The head cashier had embezzled like $200,000 from the bank. My grandfather caught him out at it. And for whatever reason, instead of immediately going to the bank president or the board of the directors, he goes to the cashier and says, I've caught you. What's going on? And the guy says, oh, I just took the, I'm going to pay it right back. So my grandfather kept putting off going to report the guy. And inevitably, of course, the bank examiner showed up and found the discrepancies. And my grandfather, even though the bank president cleared my grandfather of any wrongdoing, had no part in any of this scandal, except for the fact that he hadn't reported it earlier. My grandfather apparently was so despondent and depressed that his reputation in the community was going to be ruined that he took the bank shotgun and went into the vault one morning. And so I guess that's why my mother didn't want to talk about it. But anyhow, my brothers and sisters insisted there had to be a novel in all of this, and so there is.
You wrote the novel. Yeah, terrific, too.
Is that called?
It's called Tyndall.
We just happen to have copies up there. Baron, let's talk about, I was looking deeper at the cover of the book, which is really evocative, and it, you know, it's, there's so much in it, you know, it's the urban versus the rural. It's there are a lot of classic sort of Western tropes in these books, as well as crime fiction. And I was thinking about it, tell us a little bit more about Meriwether County. One of the things that happens in the book early on is this old school rancher, the U.S. Game and Wildlife.
Yeah,
but tell us what's going on in the book. It reminded me a little bit of those 70s novels where it was like, you know, the government versus, right, you know, like the Milagro Beanfield War is a perfect example of that, you know?
Well, it was an era, those of us who may have been there, remember, it was an era where that was happening quite a lot. And it was happening where the government was rolling over on the little guy, and kind of big guys were getting away with murder. And it was a very, very unusual time in so many different ways. This story borrows... which is one of the things I like to do, by the way. I like to borrow from history because, again, I mentioned before about guardrails. I like to have a spine in a story that keeps me on track so that we don't veer off and make things up that are sort of, beyond the pale. So I like to use as a spine for a story something that really has some historical significance. And there have been two or three, or probably more, occurrences where the government, typically it's been the Bureau of Land Management, has gone in and interfered with or just flat canceled leases on ranchers that have thousands of head of cattle on BLM leased land. And it's, you get a letter in the mail that says, okay, get them off my land day after tomorrow, or I'm taking them. And that's what they would do. They just take them, and off to the slaughterhouse goes all your stuff, and all the herds that you have tried to, and your family have tried to grow for generations, and it interferes with how you run your ranch. So for these people, for a rural person, when somebody interferes with your water or interferes with your boundary lines or your fences or any of that kind of stuff, it becomes a very, very large problem. And as large of a problem as that is in Meriwether County in the story of Reckoning, it is the catalyst to about two or three other things that seem to be unrelated that actually turn out to maybe not be as unrelated as they appear.
Yeah, and we learn kind of the seedy. I've heard a lot about the history of Portland, and we read about it, and in Oregon in general.
Yeah,
you know, the some of the settlers you refer to in several places, very hardcore. You know, and but yeah, it's kind of the lone man kind of against the corruption. Exposing the corruption.
Well, and this was it was the end of the Oregon Trail. People uprooted their lives and made enormous choices and died along the way by the thousands trying to get here. So once they got to Oregon and found that place that had the water and had the land and had what they were seeking and what they had lost family members in horrible ways and hardship to get there, you continued to fight for it.
Donner Party? Donner Party, Oregon?
That was California.
That's California. Yeah,
that was California.
Close.
But, similar problems.
Yes, exactly.
But,
different solution.
But, there was a lot of that. And then in the 60s, there was a lot of police corruption and political corruption that was enormous, that really brought about some very large congressional hearings that cost a lot of people their reputations and lives, and that was all due to some very significant misdeeds in the city of Portland. So when, as you alluded to the cover earlier, when rancher Ty Dawson, who's also conscripted as the sheriff of this county, because he's really the only guy who's kind of tough enough and has experience enough to handle the job and doesn't want it, when he is forced with having to be the sheriff of this rural county and discovers that now the city people are kind of bringing their bad acts into his world, that is absolutely a red line. And that's where the trouble ensues.
All right, Jim, I got to ask you about the new book here. Shot to the Heart. Wow. What inspired this book? I got to ask.
Okay, so this is another one of those, where do you get those ideas stories, kind of going back to South of the Deuce. I guess about 3 years ago, something on that order, I was at my cardiologist for my annual checkup. And at the end of the appointment, he was telling me, as he always does, that I have the most perfectly functioning heart it's ever been his privilege to examine, or something like that. But anyhow, as I'm getting up to leave, he says, you know, you really should write a book about a crime-fighting cardiologist. And, you know, we both laughed because it seemed like such a ridiculous idea. But, I mean, you know how this works. You plant an idea in an author's head. So a few months later, I finished the project I was working on at the time, and I was trying to decide what I might do next. And this idea just kept rolling around. And I thought, could you really write a book about a crime-fighting cardiologist? So I started playing around with it, and I came up with an idea that I thought I might work. So I called him up on the phone, and I said, hey, look, this was your bright idea. You're going to have to be the technical advisor on this book, which he's really a very nice guy, and he was a huge help in the medical details in the book. But so that's where that idea came from. Now I'm just hoping that my podiatrist doesn't read the book and get any bright ideas.
Your proctologist.
Or him. Yeah, especially him.
There's a series here.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Is it lomastazone?
Lomastazone, right.
Plays an important role in this book.
So this is not giving anything away because the murder occurs on the first page of the book. You know who the killer is, and you know how she kills her husband by administering an overdose of a drug, a blood thinner drug. And there are any number of them out there on the market. And, of course, I couldn't use a real one, so I had to invent a name. So I was trying to find a name that sounded like it would come out of one of those television commercials on the nightly news. And I thought, okay, lomastazone sounds like it might be just the drug that a person would want to take, you know, if you had a heart ailment of some kind. So that's where lomastazone comes from.
And this Cindy, the woman who commits this crime, what a piece of work. Well done.
So,
well,
the basic premise here is that there are two strong female characters in this book. The first of which is a woman named Cindy Parker, who is now in her middle 30s and nearing the end of her shelf life as a sexy convention model here in Phoenix. So her retirement plan is to seduce and marry a very wealthy man who's 30 years older than she is. And after doing that, a year later, she takes him to a very isolated, remote area of Montana and murders him by giving him an overdose of lomastazone. And she's now basically free and clear to collect the better part of $10 million. But she doesn't count on the fact that the victim's daughter, Laura Martin, is a cardiologist who knows more than a little about strokes and associated. And anyhow, Laura is absolutely convinced that this woman has murdered her father, and she's determined to prove it. So the basic structure of the novel is these two clever, determined, beautiful women, one trying to escape justice, the other one trying to bring her to justice. That's the story.
And there's actually two cardiologists.
Yes.
That would have been a fun title, too.
Two cardiologists. Her
accomplice is the aptly named Derek Tool.
Yeah.
He does seem like a tool.
Yeah.
He's like
I thought that was a name that fit the character.
He's a classic douchebag, as the kids would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it just seemed like you had an awful lot of fun writing this
book. I did. Once I figured out a direction to go with it, it was a lot. And once my cardiologist got me straightened out on the medical details, yeah, it was really fun pushing. This is one I really enjoyed going into the study every afternoon and playing with.
Let's see. Well, so he signed off on it then, the cardiologist?
He hasn't read it yet.
Right.
So we'll see.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm seeing at the end of the month, so I'll be taking him a copy then.
And then also, you know, you mentioned Laura, the doctor, there's also another private investigator that she hires,
right?
Named Monica Workman. Like that name too. Yeah. And so, a little research about, you know, these days, what a private investigator actually does, so much of it's, as you would imagine, online, you know, in these different databases. So you do get into that a little bit.
Yeah, right. I mean, my cardiologist, who's trying to solve the mystery of her father's death, needs some assistance. Basically, she needs to know the background of this woman, that sort of thing. So she hires a private detective named Monica Workman, And Monica Workman actually works the way most private detectives do these days. They're not out standing on the corner shadowing people and stuff like that. They're on their computers working through databases, and that's basically all this detective does. We never see her outside of her office. She's just there pounding the keys on the computer, you know, sorting through databases just like Emily would.
It's funny, you watch First 48. Anybody watch that great show? Yeah. You know, the criminals are always, like, posting on Facebook and doing really stupid, or Twitter,
yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's how a lot of them get caught.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else can we talk about with the new book? Anything else you'd like to cover? There's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on, and I think that what is engaging for me as a writer, and I hope always makes it to the page, in the Dawson series, is I'm glad you brought up Meriwether County, because I think the place has as much to do with what it informs the characters as much as anything else that the characters encounter. It's just the culture from which they come and their frame of reference, living the way that they do and having the expectations that they do, living in a small rural county in Oregon. And yeah, I mean, it sounds like you do the same thing with, there's a rural mentality that is different, isn't it?
Yes, there is. I do want to say, though, that as important as the setting is in your novel, not just this one, but all of them, you really create some richly developed, well-rounded characters. I mean, even the minor characters in your book are really very well done.
That is a very great compliment coming from you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you know, in the new book, some of the, for my money anyway, the most magical scenes are with Ty and his daughter Cricket.
Yeah,
you know, because she's obviously part of this young generation, and
they have a lot of conflict because of that. She's a college freshman, and she comes home and brings home her newfangled ideas, and that becomes kind of a problem too in 1973. So. You know, and it was all, you know, that was kitchen table talk for me. And these were the things, these were the conversations I alluded to earlier that I got to sort of dive a little bit deeper in and think of them through an older man's point of view and hearing all of this stuff that is so high-minded, because we all know everything when we're 18 or 19, right? And we only discover
Absolutely.
When you're 40 or 50 how little you actually know. And there's just so much hubris that young people bring to the party. So it was fun to deal with, but it was fun to also resolve it as well and to find the love in the relationship.
Well, and also his deputies are really interesting. Talk a little bit about Powell and what was it, Griffin?
There's a couple of them, both of whom he conscripted. He was conscripted, Ty Dawson was conscripted as sheriff, so fair was fair. So he goes down to his own group of cowboys that work on his ranch and asks for volunteers for deputies. So two of them step up and do so. One of them is a young black cowboy, which was very unusual back then, less so today, fortunately, but very, very unusual. And the other is a Vietnam vet that's freshly back and, you know, kind of getting his feet back on the ground as a cowboy and trying to put the Vietnam life in the rearview mirror. So these, the military aspects of their experience kind of coalesces with the Western aspects of their lives. And I hope that it makes a cogent and interesting sort of potpourri.
And there's definitely a code that they adhere to. You know, I'm not sure if it made it into the final.
It did.
Book.
It's in the very end. I actually, because I always refer to the cowboy code in this series, and I thought, well, I should probably print it. So finally, in the third volume, I put it. It's back where the acknowledgments are, and it is. It's very much the code by which all of these people live, and I think, you know, the people of the county, for that matter. It's not just the Dawson Ranch. It's the prevailing mentality of Meriwether County. So I would think that that would clarify, I would hope that it would clarify a little bit how alienating that would be when someone enters your world that has no idea what this cowboy, no respect for the cowboy code at all. It could be a little disruptive.
Right. You know, Jim, it occurs to me that I think we did a virtual event about the book, prior
South
to this.
Yeah.
No, Picture Me Gone?
No, we didn't do one for that.
Okay, well, that's why I was...
South of the Deuce is the one we did the virtual event for.
Right. It's kind of a blur these last few years.
Yeah, I know. I understand. But there can't be anybody in the book business who's working harder than you are these days.
Well, Barbara, definitely. Tell me about... Talk a little bit about Picture Me Gone, cause, since you haven't had a chance to talk
okay.
about
Picture
it.
Picture Me Gone. Early on, I did a book called Until Death, and one of the principal characters in that book was a very high-end Phoenix escort. And in doing that book and doing the research for that book, it occurred to me to wonder, what if you were a parent and somehow wound up on one of these websites where these women advertise their services, what in God's name would you think if you saw a picture of your daughter there? And that just kind of kept bugging at me. So the story of Picture Me Gone is the main character is a female executive named Molly McIntyre. She's an executive in a firm in Minneapolis. And one day, 5 years before the story opens, her idyllic life is shattered when her 17-year-old daughter Jennifer fails to come home from high school. She and her husband report the daughter missing, of course. The police investigate and conclude that Jennifer had been abducted and murdered by a sex offender who had recently been released from jail and who was living with his sister in the neighborhood. But Jennifer's body was never discovered. The police couldn't put together enough evidence to actually charge this guy with the crime, although they did charge him with some other stuff related to child pornography they found on his computer. Molly's life is then further totally destroyed when her husband, Alan, is shot and killed by the police after he shoots and kills the man that the police suspect of abducting their daughter. 5 years down the road, an anonymous friend sends Molly a link to an internet website called Fantasyland, where high-end female escorts here in Phoenix advertise their services. Molly is stunned to see on the site a picture of a young woman who looks very much like the daughter she has long assumed to be dead. So Molly races to Phoenix in an effort to try to find this woman to determine if she is her daughter, and if so, why in God's name she's been out of touch for 5 years. Complications ensue.
Wow. Let's open it up to some questions from you guys. I was afraid of this.
I want to know if Meriwether County is a real place.
It'd be southeastern Oregon is where this fictional county exists, and it is based in terms of how it appears in the book and in my mind, based a lot on where I grew up in a very rural agrarian part. Don't laugh now, of Southern California, back when there were rural agrarian parts of Southern California.
Where was that?
It was actually in Orange County, so named because there were actual oranges there. And we lived on a small ranch, horses and all that stuff, as did all of our surrounding neighbors. And our whole county was nothing but cattle ranches, strawberry fields, and orange groves. And it was a very agrarian lifestyle. And we had, I'll digress very small way here. One of the very first things I recalled informed part of South California Purples. As a kid, I recalled that our town was very concerned because a rumor had begun to circulate that the Hell's Angels were going to be swinging through town. And, you know, lock up your daughters and get out your guns. And for real. And it was really something.
Jeff Parker, I think, wrote about that, too, in one of his recent books.
Did he?
Yeah, he mentioned the same thing.
Yeah, I remember it vividly, and it was a fear that kind of permeated for a couple of weeks. And they did, in fact, pass through, but they kept going. They didn't stick around. But it was a big problem emotionally for people. Oh, gosh. Well, that's part of the reason why. You know, Hollister was a decade before, but they had torn up plenty of other places in between as well, right? So that news was not met happily and really caused a lot of consternation, that's for sure.
I always think it's amazing how all these words flow and these ideas flow. Do you ever think about not writing and you think you'll continue writing forever? Or...
Yeah, I mean, I think I said earlier at the beginning that I decided I wanted to become a writer when I was very young. And I don't think the compulsion ever leaves you. Sometimes it runs off the track for a while. But I expect I'll be writing something for the rest of my life, whether anybody will publish it or not. Of course, we'll see. But
I have thought that I was finished writing before, and turned out I wasn't, because it's just, it is like a compulsion. But when the ideas take root, they don't go away easily.
No, I mean, when your cardiologist gives you a good idea, you pretty much got to run with it.
Well, in my copy of Jim's new book, he wrote, "This could be my last." I'm like, no, it's not. Is there a question?
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Our local friend. She wanted to know how you got the inspiration of writing two women for your book, because that's unusual for a man to write two female protagonists. And did you have any readers or any people that assisted in kind of giving you assistance with the voice?
No, not really. I'm just hoping that both voices hold up. When I was trying to figure out who, you know, I was trying to come up with a plot where a cardiologist could be solving a crime. And I couldn't really see a cardiologist sitting in his office somehow deciding to take the day off to solve a murder. So I figured that the cardiologist had to be personally invested in the crime. So I thought, okay, I'll have a female cardiologist investigating or trying to determine the truth of her father's death. So that's how I want. And the other female protagonist was easy because I had to have somebody kill off the father so that the daughter could investigate. And again, I hope the voices sound right.
Another online question is for Baron. And that's Baron, do you recommend readers start with? Writing for so long, do you have a favorite book that you always like to nod the new reader towards?
There's two separate series. There's the Mike Travis series that is set in the in contemporary times, so there's cell phones involved, and that one takes place primarily in Hawaii. This series is the one that we've been speaking of now. That's where I would start. I think this has a different kind of tone and a different kind of drive, and it's where I am right now as a writer. So the next several books are likely to stay in this same series. So I would start with South California Purples, and then move through the rest, hopefully.
You should mention Rain Dogs, though.
Oh, Rain Dogs is a standalone that kind of stands in between. It's part of the Mike Travis universe in a way, but that too was set in the 70s, right. Now that I think about it. That's the first one I ever wrote that was set in the 70s, and but that for entirely different reasons. Yeah, that one's very hard-boiled, though, I would say.
Yes.
It's gritty. That one's a Sam Peckinpah movie.
Anybody else? Well, what's next? Oh, go ahead.
Jim, I can't resist. You've got at least two books that involve women from the racier side of life. What's your inspiration? Where does it come from?
Where does that come from? Okay.
Trolling,
I fell into that totally by accident. My second novel, Until Death, I was looking for a twist on the usual serial killer novel. Okay, so there are 8,000 serial killer novels where there's some guy out murdering prostitutes. So I thought, okay, what if you turned that on its head? So this book opens with the death of a couple of men that appear to be totally unrelated. And then one afternoon, this woman comes into the Phoenix Police Department and asks to speak to my detective, Sean Richardson, who's the lead on one of these two murder cases. And she says she has information about both of these murders. And he says, okay, well, so it ultimately turns out that this woman is a high-end escort, as I said, and somebody has stolen her client book and turned it into a hit list. So some of Phoenix's most prominent male citizens are suddenly being killed in innovative ways, and the detectives have to track this down. So that's how I got to that. And then, as I said, in talking about Picture Me Gone, I had that idea about, you know, what if you saw your daughter's picture on this website? So.
Well, what are you both working on now?
Go.
The fourth volume in the Ty Dawson series is finished and will be out early next year, 24. And working on number 5.
Do you actually establish the year? I don't think you do in this one, do you?
I don't. I'm consciously kind of stepping back from that. I'm trying to be more seasonal about it so that we can, you know, kind of bring that into the story.
Mid-70s, though, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right. It's going to remain in the 70s. So, yeah, we're mid-70s now.
Can you give us sort of a taste of what's going on in this new book?
In the follow-up?
The follow-up.
The follow-up is called Knife River. It involves, it too is a nested narrative that has two or three different story arcs that are going to weave together into one aha at the end. And it involves the return of a young man who left town under a cloud back years ago as a teenager because there was some question about whether something really tragic had happened at his hand. When he comes back years later, no one recognizes him at first. And then things begin to happen for him. And that's Knife River. That's the backbone of Knife River.
Sounds great.
That's a good question. When I wrote that inscription in your book, I was sort of beating my head against the wall because I have a book that I started and I've gotten, I don't know, 15 or 20,000 words into it, and I really loved where it was going. Then all of a sudden, the book stopped speaking to me. I just can't get it to move ahead anywhere. So I set it aside, and I've started something else, and I don't know if that's going to work out. But I'm hoping that sooner or later, lightning will strike, and one of these books will come to fruition, but I have no idea.
Does it start with both you guys with voice? Do you hear a character talking to you, or is it more of a setup, like an idea?
For me, it's more of a setup, I think. It's the idea, and then I hope I can find a character that fits it.
Right.
Yeah, there's a there will be a narrative backbone that will occur to me that I think, oh wow, that'd be a fun place to start. Then what happens next for me is a title to go with, so that I can write to the title of that book, and try to keep the tone and the narrative, and use language that is consistent with how that title should feel.
Interesting.
I assume that was me.
Okay, go ahead.
As I mentioned, there's always been a soundtrack that goes with these. I was asked several years ago to start putting the soundtrack into the books. There is an allusion or a mention of it at the end of Reckoning, I think Fistful of Rain as well. So you can actually follow the soundtrack that I was listening to as I was thinking through. Now, I don't listen to music when I write. I write in dead silence. But when I'm finished and I go home afterwards, I want to remain in the 70s. I want to remain in the zone, emotionally speaking, and that's why the soundtracks exist. But they are listed there, and they tend to make the song titles tend to make their ways into the stories as well. So you can spot it pretty easily if you know music.
Yeah. Like you, I don't listen to music when I know a lot of people who do, and I cannot concentrate. I have to lock myself in my study, close the blinds, eliminate all distractions. My Sean Richardson character is one of those detectives who listens to a lot of music, although he's kind of all over the map. I did put together a Spotify playlist, which is called South of the Deuce, the music of Sean Richardson. And I put together the songs that he's listened to through the first four books in that series. But I mean, as I say, they're all over the place, from Billie Holiday to, you know, Brian Chartrand to all kinds of folks.
Dave Alvin.
Dave Alvin, yes. Absolutely. Dave Alvin. No Willie Blouton, no. No D-Lines.
No.
I hadn't started. You hadn't turned me on to those guys yet.
Yeah, we always nerd
speaking
out about
of Portland.
Music. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Well, let's see. If there are no more questions, maybe we'll wrap it up and have you guys sign some books for us.
Okay, great.
Sound
thank
good?
You all for being here.
Thank
this
you very
really
much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody online,
been a lot
too.
Of fun. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.